recognize that song? Pretty good chance you don't. Not one of the better-known Beach Boys songs. It's credited as a Dennis Wilson composition. It's a song called Never Learn Not to Love. It was, in fact, a song written by Charles Manson and recorded by the Beach Boys. Now, you can find that on YouTube. You can find that song around. I mean, it made it onto a Beach Boys album and everything, but what you may not know about Charles Manson is just how connected he really became in show business. How many people had to go into a complete PR control spin to sort of disavow their contact with Charles Manson. And we'll get to some of those famous names coming up a little bit later on in the show. And most importantly, just how pervasive the evil of Charles Manson really is. And how many other connections this Manson family has made and continues in a way to have influence over. The book is called The Shadow Over Santa Susana, Black Magic, Mind Control, and the Manson Family Mythos. You do not know just how dark the evil of the Manson family is until you stick around, and you will be amazed at all of the people that came through Charles Manson's life, or should I say, all the lives that Charles Manson helped destroy years after he was put into prison. More on that coming up on Coast to Coast AM. Next, this is Ian Punnett. Well, you know, as I say, it's hard to fight evil until you know just how strong it is, how pervasive it is. And the full story has never been realized on the Manson family until now. The Shadow Over Santa Susana, Adam Gorightly joins us. Hey, Adam.
Hi, Ian. Thanks for having me on.
Well, you know, and thank you, too, for writing this book. I thought I knew tons about the Manson family, and I feel like an idiot. There's so much in here. Now, I want to point out up front, too, again, kind of like our book last hour, this may not be for everybody. I mean, you tell the stories very frankly in this book. You don't pull a lot of punches, and there are some photographs that I've never seen or even knew existed. Are some of these crime scene photographs, and some of these are autopsy photographs? How did you get permission, or where did you even get these photos that appear in the book?
Quite graphic photos, and the publisher was able to get a hold of a lot of those. They are crime scene photos and autopsy photos, and some of them have been published in previous books. I assume a lot of the stuff is public domain.
No, maybe I haven't read all of those books on the. I thought I'd read a lot, but you caught me off guard with a lot of this material, and it's fascinating. And the book is "The Shadow Over Santa Susana: Black Magic, Mind Control, and the Manson Family Mythos." I want to put off some of the darker stuff for just a little bit. Mm-hmm. And since we played that Beach Boys song at the beginning of the hour that Charles Manson had written and the Beach Boys had recorded, it reminded me of the story that you recount in your book, which I was just telling somebody 2 weeks ago before the movie Public Enemies opened with John Dillinger, because of the connection with another famous gangster from that era, Alvin Creepy Karpus. And I was so glad you put that in your book, because I was telling people about this connection between Charles Manson and Alvin Creepy Karpus of the Barker gang, and nobody believed me. So I can now show them your book.
Part of Charlie's formative years when he was in reformatory schools and later in prisons, those were his teachers and mentors, and one of them was Alvin Creepy Karpus, like you said, former public enemy number one, member of the mob Barker gang. And oddly enough, Karpus taught Charlie how to play guitar. And
in prison.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And he commented, Creepy Karpus said at the time that, you know, he thought that Charles Manson was a punk, and he was going to teach him guitar because he wanted to learn how to play guitar. And he said that that Manson had this attitude like he was going to be bigger than the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
and so, I mean, what an interesting kind of foreshadowing that if Alvin Creepy Karpus hadn't taught Charles Manson how to play the guitar, then maybe the events of the Manson family might never have happened.
You know, I've never looked at it like that, but that's a good point. That was part of his entrance, you know, into the rock and roll world. He made some contacts while in prison, actually. A guy named Phil Kaufman. This was in, around 66, 67, right before Charlie got released from Terminal Island Prison in San Francisco. This guy, Phil Kaufman, heard him playing guitar, and he said, "Hey, Charlie, I know some contacts at Universal Studios. When you get out, I'll give you their names, and you can look them up." And from there, once Charlie got released on the infamous date of 9/11/1967, he recorded some demo sessions there at Universal Studios. So that was part of his entrance into that world, was his musical abilities, such as they were.
Well, and that, you know, just even to push that point a little bit further, you know, if Alvin Creepy Karpus, former Public Enemy number one, who in his own right was pretty evil in his day, he had that really super creepy smile, which he seemed to take a certain amount of pride in, kind of a twisted fellow in his own right. If he hadn't taught Charles Manson how to play the guitar, Manson might not have gotten the legitimacy that the later music and showbiz contacts that Charles Manson had. And if he hadn't gotten that kind of legitimacy, he might not have attracted the people that he attracted.
Oh, no doubt. And he, also used his guitar playing, and he was a decent lyricist. That was probably his strong suit. And vocally, he was kind of a second-rate lounge singer type, but this is how he met a lot of his young women. For instance, the first recruit into the Manson family, Mary Bruner, saw Charlie outside of the Berkeley Public Library. She was a librarian there playing his guitar and got entranced by his music and this what she saw as a magical little man who had a lot of answers.
Well, and this magical little man eventually, obviously, got to be friends with Dennis Wilson of the Beach Boys and was able to kind of sucker Dennis Wilson into the Manson family through these sex orgies, which Charlie offered up whenever he wanted. But then also even ingratiating himself a little bit with Brian Wilson, mm-hmm. which after the whole Manson family thing, I remember distinctly reading that the Wilson family barely had any contact with Charlie and that they thought he was weird and they tried to get away from him as fast as possible. But when I'm reading your book, I realized, no. They were absorbed by Charlie Manson for a long time before they finally pushed away from the table.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How that all came about, Manson-Wilson connection. A couple of Manson's girls, Patricia Krenwinkel, one of the murderers at one of the Tate LaBianca murderers, and another gal named Marty Reeves, were out hitchhiking one day on the Pacific Coast Highway, and Dennis Wilson picked them up, took them back to his pad to quote-unquote show him his gold records. And had sex with both of them. So they found out where Wilson lived off of Sunset Boulevard. And so later Wilson, sometimes afterwards, Wilson came back from an all-night recording session. And there's a party going on in his house. And it's the Charlie's girls all in various states of undress. And Manson walked out as Wilson pulled up and pulled one of his stunts where he got down on his hands and knees and kissed his feet and welcomed Wilson into his own house. And so, you know, that was a very appealing scene for a lot of these rock and rollers, this guru messiah guy with this band of young, sexually promiscuous women. And Charlie had drugs as well available. It was he used this was his M.O. to set people into his scene, such as Dennis Wilson.
Well, and then I thought, you know, to extend the story a little bit further, they record this song later on. The Beach Boys record this song written by Charles Manson. And Manson achieves a level of legitimacy within recording circles that you mention in the book. You actually have articles where, you know, like Dennis Wilson is bragging about signing, you know, Charles Manson potentially to, you know, the label that the Beach Boys had started. And other people within the recording business are touting this this unknown talent, this guy who's on the rise, this guy who, you know, sort of talking about him like he's going to be the next Dylan. And yeah. You think, well, this guy had he had a lot of people under his spell that I would never have imagined would have fall for it. But in particular, I like the story that I'd never heard before. And I'm a Beach Boys fan, and I read a lot about the Beach Boys. I've never heard this story about Brian Wilson and that song that scared him to death. Can you talk about that?
It's the song called Fire, I believe.
Yeah.
Memory serves correct. And it was part of those Smile sessions that was going on during this period. It was 67, 68. Brian Wilson was trying to break away from the typical Beach Boy music as we know it and get into more psychedelic and, you know, that type of music. And one of these songs was called Fire, which he recorded with a full-scale orchestra. And this was during that whole period where Manson was kind of hovering around them all. And as I recall the anecdote, they recorded it one night, and a short time afterwards in a building nearby caught on fire, and Wilson was concerned, and he believed that he had basically done some type of ritual magic incantation with that music, and so he went ahead and destroyed those tapes. Now
hold on a second. Now I'll refresh your memory in your book for you. It wasn't just the fact that while he recorded that song, the next day he found out the building next door to the recording studio had burned down. Over the next couple of days he worked on that song, he also discovered that there had been a series of forest fires that had spontaneously developed at the same time and were threatening the whole community. And he was convinced that the song and the fires had a connection. But as I remembered from your book, he didn't destroy it. He just merely had the song buried in the in the archives, and that the tape may exist somewhere, but it's never seen the light of day. Is that how you remember it?
Yeah, true. I guess that sounds right. I think the phrase that jumps in my head now that he locked it away in the Capitol vault.
Yeah.
And he never wanted it to be played again. So maybe it's still out there. You know, those Smile sessions. I don't know if you're familiar with those. That's some great stuff.
Yeah, I own the album. This is the famous psychedelic album from mostly Brian Wilson that they never, Capitol didn't allow them to release, and wasn't finished until recently, and now it's out on CD. Now, but this is, again, what's interesting about this is Brian Wilson at a time, Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys, at a time when he's hanging out with Charles Manson, who's yet to lead his Manson family into the Tate-LaBianca murders that are known, you know, so well as the Helter Skelter murders of the late 1960s. So he hadn't actually committed any crimes yet that anybody would have known of, but Brian Wilson had kind of a premonition of just how violent and weird Charles Manson was going to be. And Brian Wilson even, like, banned him from the studio?
He kicked him out of the studio that was actually at his house where he recorded those Smile sessions, and that's where Dennis Wilson set up some further demo sessions with Charlie and a producer, I believe his name was Steve Desper. But the vibe started getting weird. Manson was pulling out buck knives and these type of things, and they were real, you know, kind of slobs and making a mess of the house and just a bad scene. And eventually, Wilson gave him the boot.
People who distanced themselves from Charles Manson kind of did it at their own peril. That there were a lot of people that were catching on to the dark side of Charles Manson, but it took them a while. And one of those people, I thought this was an interesting point you made, Terry Melcher, who was the son of Doris Day. that he, too, was much more involved with Charles Manson, now that we can look back on a little more honestly, than was alluded to at the time. It was said that Terry Melcher was an acquaintance of Charles Manson. They knew where Terry Melcher lived, but that when he went to the house, Terry Melcher no longer lived in the house, and that's where Sharon Tate lived, and that's why they killed everybody in that house. Now, that's generally known, mm-hmm. but tell us the whole story of just how close that contact was between Manson and Doris Day's son, who had become a fairly successful record producer.
Well, yeah, Melcher, he produced some pretty big acts, the Byrds and Paul Revere and the Raiders, who were pretty hot during that period. And he was tight with Dennis Wilson. It was actually Dennis Wilson who turned him on to Manson. As I said, Dennis Wilson really thought quite highly of Charlie at that time, called him his wizard, kind of his mentor. And so Melcher had designs, perhaps, if we believe what Manson said, of recording an album. There's even some type of film in the works for a period of time. One of the first incidents that happened that kind of set off Helter Skelter was a shooting of a black drug dealer named Otsa Papa Crow that Manson was involved in. And it's really the only violent crime, aside from slashing the ear of murder victim Gary Hinman, that Manson was involved in. Others executed the murders, but at the scene of this shooting of Otsa Papa, that was his nickname, Otsa Papa Crow, Bernard Crow was a friend of Dennis Wilson named Brian Lucas, and Brian Lucas informed Dennis Wilson, and Terry Melcher got wind of this in late 68, early 69, about this shooting. And at that time, Wilson severed his contact with Manson, thinking he'd gotten out of control.
Yeah, but Terry Melcher, I mean, Doris Day's son, it seems like after the Tate LaBianca murders, he really, he sets up kind of a very sanitized version of his relationship with Charles Manson, which seemed much more like he was much more interested in him working with him as an artist and he too was kind of into this Charles Manson circle of friends or people that were taking advantage of the sexual opportunities of the Manson family girls.
Yeah.
But that story you tell, and I have never heard it before, that Charles Manson went to the mansion where the girls and others would go back to later on and commit the murders, that he was actually there. Was it the day before or the day of the Manson murders? Remember?
I believe it was a short period of time, like the day before.
Okay. And he went there. He went to the mansion looking for whom? Why did he go to the mansion? And he came like this close to actually seeing or talking with Sharon Tate before he would send all those people back to do the killing.
Indeed, yeah, he was there looking for Mr. Melcher.
Now, that's way interesting. And that he had gone there, he had pounded on the door, and they had a butler had come to the door or something and said, "You go away?"
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed.
And inside were the future victims of the first round of murders for the Manson family. Well, as you're already hearing, there's just more to this story than you've ever been told before. I want to get into the Son of Sam connection, and even into this very unusual connection to the death of John Lennon.
Yeah.
As they all sort of extend out, they all sort of radiate out from Charles Manson. Shadow over Santa Susana, Black Magic, Mind Control, and the Manson family mythos. And then I've never heard it explained so well, where the theology of Charles Manson came from. What was the combination that went into this unique sort of worldview that worked so well for Charles Manson? I've never heard of the Scientology connection before to Charles Manson, but you'll hear about it next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So we're talking about the pervasive evil, the satanic evil that was Charlie Manson. And you know, we use that term a lot, and true Luciferians may argue and say, well, he wasn't one of us, and why, you can't use the term satanic around him, except that Charles Manson did. And he thought he was practicing a form of Satanism, but also a form of Scientology. And I've never heard that before. We'll get to that coming up in just a minute. Also, about Terry Melcher, there, we played some music from The Byrds that was produced by Terry Melcher, who is also Doris Day's son. And we'll get back to a little bit more of that story, the night that Helter Skelter happened. And what Charles Manson was trying to achieve, what he thought he had the power to do, and where that idea came from that he had the power to do it. It's part of the Shadow Over Santa Susana, Black Magic, Mind Control, and the Manson Family Mythos next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So let's start with the Scientology thing, because this brings us back into Charles Manson in prison, back when he was learning how to play the guitar from Alvin Creepy Karpus, formerly Public Enemy Number One. How did he get into Scientology, and how is that confirmed?
Yeah, as the story goes, and there's various sources for this. The first source I saw was Ed Sanders in his book The Family. Talking about the period of time that Manson was at McNeil Island Prison in Washington State. This was in the 50s, during that period where the book Dianetics became a pop culture fad and evolved into Scientology, the religion L. Ron Hubbard created. And there was a guy at McNeil Island Prison who had studied under L. Ron Hubbard by the name of Lanier Rainier. And this Rainier fellow, he gathered a group around him that he schooled in Scientology, and Manson was among that group. And according to Charlie, during that period he studied under Lanier Rainier, he ascended to the highest level of Scientology, which is that of a operating Thetan, as it's called. And so there's other stories as well about the Manson family and Scientology connections. Apparently, when he got out, and this is material that was undercovered through all different government documents, FBI documents, Manson attended a celebrity center. There's a celebrity center of Scientology in L.A., and they had a banquet there that Manson attended. Also, they found Scientology material at Spahn Ranch, as well as an e-meter, that device Scientologists use that they hook up to people, and it's a typical thing used in Scientology. One of the most interesting things I heard, and this came from he's a late great conspiracy researcher some of your listeners may know by the name of Jim Keith, wrote a lot of great books. And Keith, who I corresponded with quite a bit during the late 90s when I was writing this book, he had been an executive of Scientology, and then he got out of it, of course. And he was telling me that from within Scientology, he heard that Manson was a, what is called, quote-unquote, a body router, or what is how they term a recruiter for Scientology. So you have all these little connections, these dangling threads, and that's what I kind of try to do with the book, is to tie them all together. But, you know, ultimately it's up to the reader to come to their own decisions. I don't...
Well, but I think this, if we're going to talk about what the theology was behind Charles Manson and how he was able to manipulate people so well, the Scientology part would be, you know, some of it, but also his mix of satanic worship and getting the whole Wicca thing involved in it, that by stirring all these together in kind of a boiling cauldron, he came up with his own brand. It wasn't obviously pure Scientology, but you know, because all the girls in the group, they all called themselves witches, right?
Yeah. Well, he was using what is known as sex magic. According to the legends, once again, Charlie had incredible staying power, could have sex for hours with these girls, and when he'd recruit a new girl into the family, that's what he'd do with them, and he'd have sex with them to the point where they were just exhausted and would go into a trance state, and that's when he would be able to do his programming. The same with the, they had some pretty full-scale orgies with LSD, and once again, that he used those to program his folks. He'd bring them all together, and Charlie always gave more acid to his family members than he did to himself, so he could orchestrate and control these proceedings. And this is the same type of mojo that Aleister Crowley was involved with, stirring up these energies through sex magic,
tantric
sex.
And these, and he considered himself either Jesus Christ or the devil. We've heard him, you know, talk about that even in TV interviews where he's saying, I'll be whatever you want me to be. I'll be Jesus Christ, I'll be the devil. But this was part of what he was able to do. He did get everybody in his group to start thinking of themselves as witches and for them to think of him as the devil or as their savior.
The devil and Christ all mixed together in this strange stew where good and evil could coexist with each other. And so it's easy to justify that if everything you do is for the right and for love, as they would say, then there is no wrong.
Adam Gorightly is this author of this book about the shadow over Santa Susanna. It's all about Charles Manson and all of these other connections that had come through either Charles Manson's life or the ways in which Charles Manson had gone through other people's life. Let's talk about the Son of Sam connection. It's interesting. I mean, some of these things that you bring up in the book, I've just never heard of before. So fill that in for people that don't know. And by the way, too, remember, we're talking about a guy who was convicted of and is still on death row, such as it is. He's a lifer in California in the state prisons for his involvement in the murders of Sharon Tate and several other prominent people at her mansion, an up-and-coming actress, and then also later on at the home of a couple that were owners of grocery stores. So how does this end up becoming a connection to Son of Sam?
Pretty interesting how Berkowitz comes up. First connecting point, perhaps, is to talk about MKUltra and the late conspiracy researcher Mae Brussel believe that the Manson family was some type of MKUltra operations, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners are aware of the history of MKUltra. It was the basically a mind control program that the CIA got involved with in 1952 when it all started, and they used different drugs such as LSD and electric shock therapy to basically see how they could program people and ultimately create Manchurian candidates, programmed killers. And so Mae Brussel, when she was looking into this material, she discovered that, you know, a lot of these operations took place in the military, these LSD, MKUltra-type operations. And Berkowitz was involved in just, you know, one such operation when he was in Korea. The military, he was a profile candidate, and apparently he got this type of indoctrination into the, you know, this shadowy world, and Mae Brussel called him the son of Uncle Sam. Now, after he got out in the late 70s is when the murders, the Son of Sam murders, took place, and were a lot of you, I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with the story, or what some would say is a cover story that some old dog talked to Berkowitz and instructed him to commit the murders, that he was a nut, another lone nut, you know, like a lot of the killers in political assassinations. Now, later on, a book came out called The Ultimate Evil, where this fellow Maury Terry put together this theory, and he interviewed Berkowitz at length, and Berkowitz claimed that he was a member of a cult and that there were other players involved. And recently, you know, more information has come out. Some of the investigators who are involved in some Son of Sam putting forth evidence that there was more than one killer. Anyway, at one point, Berkowitz told a fellow inmate that Manson belonged to this cult that Berkowitz belonged to. Manson was involved with the Los Angeles chapter of this cult and was working on orders from the cult when he directed the Tate LaBianca murders.
Now, and I was just leaning back here and listening to you. There's so much more to that, though, because if Charlie were involved in the L.A. branch of this particular cult, it wasn't the only connection that he had to a cult. Talk about the group that's called The Process.
Uh-huh. That Maury Terry's book gets pretty deep into The Process, Church of the Final Judgment. And these connections were first alluded to by Ed Sanders in his book, The Family. The Process Church really evolved out of Scientology.
An interesting coincidence, but grew out of Scientology in England.
Right. And the two people that founded Scientology, their names were Robert Moore and Marianne McLean. They got married and changed their last name to De Grimston for some reason. I've never quite figured that one out. And they broke from Scientology. At first, they started a outfit called Compulsions Analysis, I believe it was called. But that evolved. It became more religious, mystical, and they started this occult order called the Process Church of the Final Judgment that basically, like Charlie, they worshiped multiple deities, or they brought the powers of good and evil together. Their followers worshiped either Lucifer or Satan or Jehovah. One wonders how you can do that, but it seems...
Well, they had a theory, right? That there, wasn't it the process that said, if Jesus says, love your enemy, and the enemy of Jesus was Satan, then you have to love both Christ and Satan.
That sounds right out of the canon of Manson.
Yeah.
And there seemed to be, the more you look into it, there was connections. The process came over to California during the Summer of Love, 67, and landed in the Haight-Ashbury. It's kind of a recruiting trip for them. And oddly enough, they were based on Cole Street, only two blocks from where the Manson family was during that period. Later in 68, the family hung out at a place called the Spiral Staircase, where supposedly the Process Church of the Final Judgment also hung out. And
that was a mansion. It was called the Spiral. That was a nickname for this gothic two-story mansion that had a winding staircase in the middle.
Yeah, and that's where Charlie said, and this is documented in the book, Manson in His Own Words, by the author Newell Emmons. Charlie said that that's where everything really spiraled out of control, and his family went on a very dark path, starting with and after, you know, meeting some of the people they did there.
Well, because up until that point, Charles Manson makes the point, up until this one occasion that they should start living in or hanging out with these people that form something called The Process, which is like Scientology once removed.
Yeah.
Until he starts hanging out with them at this mansion, he looks at himself as kind of a merry prankster. They're dropping acid, they're having sex, but they're not thinking about killing anybody. And it's during that period where things start to get really weird.
Mm-hmm.
According to Charles Manson, that's when they got weird. And it was things he picked up while he was hanging out in that mansion, which we should mention was also at one time owned by Bela Lugosi, which, you know, everybody knows as Dracula. So let's go forward, though, a little bit in time. Here it is a couple years later, and Charles Manson is already on trial for the Tate LaBianca murders. for these horrible mutilating murders that happened in California. And he's a guest article writer for this magazine that's being put out in England by this group called The Process. They have a popular monthly magazine. And in the publication where they've asked Manson to write an article, on the front cover is Marianne Faithfull, who at the time was Mick Jagger's girlfriend and a well-known pop singer in her own right.
Yeah, the Stones also seem to come up in this story quite a bit, but the title of it was something like Psycho Profundity in Death, penned by Charles Manson. And this, once again, was during the trials. Bugliosi started looking into these Process connections, wondering what the heck was going on. At one time, he asked Charlie, do you know Robert De Grimston? And Charlie said, basically, Robert De Grimston and I are one and the same. Now, a short time after that, a couple members of the Process Church visited Charlie in prison. And no one knows exactly what happened at this meeting, but afterwards he pretty much clammed up for good about the Process Church, and we haven't heard him say anything about it since then.
So, again, it's sort of a weird mix of Satanism, or at least sort of, you know, curbside Satanism, a mix of that, a mix of some Wicca in there, then also Scientology. And this all together swirling around in Manson's mind becomes his own, you know, form of religious indoctrination to get people under his spell. And they did think of him as a god. I mean, they did. I mean, his followers, they were totally upside down in Manson. It was just so surprising to think that some magazine in England would be publishing articles that would have, you know, Mick Jagger's girlfriend, you know, posing on the cover, and then have an article from Manson on the inside. It stunned me. And you make the point about how many times Mick Jagger comes up intersecting the life of Charles Manson, and that was surprising.
Let me also mention, you know, the stew we're mixing up here with all these different things, that Eastern religion was part of the whole thing. He wove into it, too. You know, that song you played at the beginning, Never Learn Not to Love. The original title was Cease to Exist. The Beach Boys thought that was a little severe, so they toned it down a little bit. But that was part of the theology, too, you know, which he got out of Eastern religion, was that to attain a higher level of consciousness and become one with the universe, you had to kill your own ego and cease to exist. Later, you know, those words took on a more ominous overtone.
Sure. Well, coming up, I want to get to the connection with the killer of John Lennon, with Mark David Chapman, as he kind of radiates out these 6 degrees of Charles Manson, which is essentially what we're talking about in the book, The Shadow Over Santa Susana, Black Magic, Mind Control, and the Manson Family Mythos. Final thought on that MK Ultra thing. Any other source, have we been able to look in, like, even maybe, you know, now could it be revealed kind of a, you know, application for the government, where that they would finally tell us whether or not Charles Manson was ever involved in MK Ultra? I mean, is there Freedom of Information Act material available on that? I'm curious.
You know, that's a good one. I'm sure somebody's done a Freedom of Information Act. I think that they'd want to cover that up, but it sounds like we're going to a break. You should ask me about the connection between Sarah Jane Moore and Squeaky Fromm in regards to possible MK Ultra tomfoolery.
Well, let's get to that then, coming up next. And also as we making these connections as they continue, some more people that you'd never would imagine that get connected to Charles Manson and to the Manson family, and just how the evil that was generated by the Manson family lives on in a very sort of palpable way. More on that coming up next hour. The blog is up too at coasttocoastam.com. And thanks always for your comments, and enjoy reading those. If you missed crypto news earlier in the evening, very cool ghost stories linked up at coasttocoastam.com on the blog. This is Ian Punnett.